Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho. Welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on BBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. And by the Rockstar Chronicles, one of my new books featuring over 45 intimate conversations with the greatest music legends the world will ever know, available now at bookbaby.com and amazon.com. Rick Wakeman's work on the classic albums of the progressive rock band Yes, his hugely successful solo albums, as well as his contributions to classic David Bowie songs, has earned him a reputation of one of rock's greatest ever keyboardists. Classically trained on his piano, he later attended the Royal College of Music. He first made his name as a session musician at Trident Studios. Among his notable early works was playing mellotron on David Bowie's breakthrough single, Space Oddity. Bowie subsequently asked Wakeman to play on his Hunky Dory album, which has become one of his most acclaimed works, and produced the songs Life on Mars, Changes, and Oh, You Pretty Things, which all featured Wakeman on piano. In the early 1970s, Wakeman was one of the most sought-after keyboardists in Britain. He played on albums by The Straubs and was receiving offers to join the progressive rock band Yes and David Bowie's band, The Spiders from Mars, at the same time. He chose to join Yes, and during his time with the band, they recorded several of the most famous albums of the progressive rock genre, including Fragile, Close to the Edge, and Tales from Topographic Oceans. Wakeman also recorded some hugely successful solo albums during the 1970s, principally The Six Wives of Henry VIII, Journey to the Center of the Earth, and The Myths and Legends of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. Rick Wakeman and the English Rock Ensemble recently released The Red Planet. The album features 8 newly composed pieces, especially for this project. It harks back to Wakeman's critically acclaimed debut album, The Six Wives of Henry VIII, where there were 6 heavy keyboard pieces based around a central subject matter. Please welcome legendary keyboardist, songwriter, producer, television, radio presenter, and author, Rick Wakeman, to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Rick.
You just made me realize how old I am.
I'm right there with you, man.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm sitting there going, did I do that? Thank you very much for that very kind intro.
Oh, man, you've done a lot more than that, but I just can't fit it into the show.
Yeah, so hopefully there's a lot more to come.
Yes, I think so. Let me tell you, man, I'm giving The Red Planet 5 stars. I really, really loved it. I'm a big prog fan, and I'm always into space music and that kind of thing. And it's a great album. I really, really enjoyed it.
That's really kind. I've been through it. It's had fantastic reviews, and you just never know when you do something like this how it's going to be received. But it's been really received so well, which means a lot because we worked really hard on it. We really did.
Well, all the titles of the song, some of them are hard to pronounce because they're in Latin, and they are
hard, and even tracks like Tharsis Tholus. I've got a friend of mine, and this is not being in any way detrimental to any health issues. I have a very close friend who has quite a pronounced lisp, and when he got the album, I gave him a pretty copy of it to listen to, and he said, Rick, he said, did you deliberately pick a title that I can't say?
And that would sound like...
I said, well, you could try Francis Polis if you like, and the... you're right, it's all areas of Mars. Mars is the most fascinating place.
Yes.
Fascinating planet. And I've always had a bit of an interest in Mars, because, as you probably well know, about 2 million years ago, it was the closest thing to what Earth is now. It had oceans, it had rivers. The only thing it had that we didn't have was much less oxygen. But it was very close to Earth. So I've always found it fascinating.
What's really cool is you pick certain areas of Mars for each title. And
yeah.
How did you do that? How did you find those locations?
Well, I knew a little bit before, quite a lot before. I'm involved with a big festival called Starmus.
Right.
And Starmus is a festival of music and science, astrophysics. And it was founded by the late Stephen Hawking,
mm-hmm.
Brian May, and who is an astrophysicist, as you probably know, and a man called Garrick Israelian. And Garrick is the man who proved black holes. Very clever guy,
right.
a true rocket scientist. And I was introduced to them all by Brian May, and because he knew of my love of space. And you know, I have a lot of friends at NASA, and in fact, they very kindly sent quite a lot of my music up into space, which is where some people said it should stay. It was very kind of them to send it up, and I've got wonderful pictures of crews of the shuttle with my CDs floating around inside, which is quite good fun. But I was speaking to Garrick a few years ago, because we were putting together a big concert to celebrate the moon landing, 50 years of the moon landing.
Right.
And we did the concert in Zurich last year. I did it with Hans Zimmer, Brian May, Steve Vai, a big orchestra and choir, and we had every astronaut that was still alive that had walked on the moon. They were all there from Buzz Aldrin downwards, and it was the most amazing event. And prior to that, when we were putting that together, I spoke to Garrick about what else he's got planned, and he said that 2021 was the 50th anniversary of the first trips to Mars.
Mm-hmm.
And I went, "God, is it that long?" He said, "Yeah." And I just thought, what a great subject matter to inspire you musically. So I came back home. I got a load of my books out that I've got. I looked online for a lot of stuff. I contacted friends of mine at NASA who sent me some amazing pictures that had not before been published. And it was just, the music just flowed. It was absolutely such a brilliant subject. If I've got what I call an inspirational subject, then life becomes wonderful for me. And Mars was certainly that subject that I've been looking for.
I'm with you on that. I'm a big space buff myself. And I thought it was so cool that, you know, I mean, most of these tracks are about, you know, the locations are volcanoes, of course, in different regions.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, the planet is very much made up of volcanoes.
Mm-hmm.
There are other fascinating areas as well, like, as you know, the poles. They have their iced over. They have ice. They also have storms. That they have, but the rain is dry ice, which is great because that's so rock and roll as well. It is a fascinating place. And what I did when I was writing the music, I had pictures of Mars scattered all over the piano, because everything was written on the piano.
Right.
And I had pictures scattered all over it while I was writing it. And so that's all I thought about for months and months.
That's fascinating. That is really fascinating. You know, the new pictures from Mars are incredible. You know, I go to the NASA website.
I know.
Yeah.
And there's three more missions have just happened as well. So who knows what more might come back?
Well, they're going to send the first woman and next man to the moon. I think that's by 2024. And then they're going to send a rocket, I guess, from the moon to Mars. I guess that's how they're going to get to Mars, right?
Yeah, I mean that's the next stage. It's obviously the moon, I think, was always meant to be a sort of a hub,
right?
To where to scoot off to after that. I think that there's going to be a lot more of Mars that's going to really surprise us. I keep harking back to my great friend David Bowie, who you made reference to at the beginning. Is there life on Mars? David could well turn out to be right.
Yeah, I think so. And who knows what they're not telling us, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I know for a fact that from astronaut friends of mine, of people that we don't know the half of it. There is so much we don't know, and for various reasons the information has not been released. One very famous astronaut friend of mine who will remain nameless for obvious reasons, I said to him once, I said, is there other stuff out there? What do you think? And he said, anybody who believes that we are all that there is in the millions of galaxies that there are out there, he said, we are not even a grain of sand in the desert.
Yeah, that's true.
He said, anybody really says, oh no, there's nothing else out there, he said, then they are incredibly narrow-minded and ignorant.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. Yep. I mean, there's got to be a reason for this this huge universe.
Some good friends of mine who have said to me, who have been up on the shuttle, and they said, look, what you see when you look up at the sky is a mere pinprick of what there is out there.
Yep.
It's just galaxy after galaxy. There's stuff that certainly in my lifetime, and probably in my grandchildren's lifetime, they will never find, but they will keep discovering things. And I just think it's wonderful, I must admit.
I had a conversation, Michael Pinder from the Moody Blues.
He actually saw a
whole fleet of UFOs once. And he was telling me a couple stories that he has seen things up in the sky. He's a believer. I think they gave him a nickname of Moon Boy or something like that.
Yeah. Well, there's no doubt about it, but everything from pilots to members of the Air Force to people, astronauts who've been up. There's been so many things seen, and it's all logged. But for whatever reasons, it's all kept quiet.
Yeah, I agree.
The interesting thing is when things leak out and people hear, if any government ever thought, well, we don't say anything because we don't want to panic people, I don't think it does, because it just fascinates people. I mean, Roswell is a classic example of it fascinates people. No one's frightened by it.
No. I think we're ready for it.
Yeah, I mean, there's very close to where I live. I live in a county of Suffolk in England, and way back a few years there was an American Air Force base, and that is one of the most famous places for where a load of Air Force witnessed a UFO land,
right.
And then take off, and then come back the following day. And yet, somehow, it was all managed to be covered up. They've done television programs about it, and it's quite fascinating. How people who saw something could be told they didn't see it.
Exactly.
And a lot of people as well.
Yeah.
I just think it's a fascinating subject, and I think that the one thing that governments have got wrong, they think if they release what they know, it would panic people. I don't think it would at all. I think people would just be excited to know more.
I agree with you 100%. I'm with you on that. I want to read you something from your old bandmate Chris Squire. I interviewed him during when he put out Squawk It with Steve Hackett.
And, oh, yeah, yeah.
And he came out with a song called Aliens.
Yes.
In which he says they're really just, you know, us from the future, is what he said about it. So he believes that the aliens we see now, the UFOs, are actually us from the future, and that we have. What do you think about that statement?
I think that's entirely plausible. Yep. I mean, it's I think that's entirely plausible. I mean, there's Chris was quite a far thinking and far reaching person, and I mean, I know the album very well because Steve Hackett's a great friend of mine as well, and I thought it was a really, really good album.
I did too.
It was something that I think it was such a shame that Chris's life was cut so short, because I would have loved to have seen, apart from his work with Yes that he was obviously doing, I think a tour of Skrakit would have been really good.
Yeah, I asked him too. I says, you know, I love Fish Out of Water. You know, that was a great album.
Fish Out of Water was a great album.
Yeah.
I mean, and nobody else really could have used that title for an album.
No.
I mean, as you know, because his nickname was Fish.
Yeah.
Surprisingly enough, not because he liked swimming, it was because he spent so much time in the bath, it was almost impossible to get him out. so he was known as the Fish. So Fish Out of Water was just the perfect title for that album. Chris had a great advantage over all of the other instrumentalists in Yes,
right.
Is he was the only one, obviously with the exception of John, of course, who was a lead singer, who had a lead singing voice. He had a great voice, Chris. He was a trained singer. I mean, he was a cathedral choir boy.
Huh.
And he knew his stuff. He knew his harmonies and he knew his thing. So he had that great advantage when he did Fish Out of Water, of knowing that he could put some vocals on it that would really stand out. It was a great album.
Yeah, I asked him about a Fish Out of Water too, and he just laughed.
Yeah, that sounds like Fish. that sounds like it.
Well, the album's incredible. I love every piece. It's wonderful. Some of the tracks I really liked, I think, was, is it Arceus? Arceus Mons?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Arceus Mons. It's Arceus Mons. Acrobius, you know, pronouncing them is not the easiest thing. But I want you to do the correct titles, the
sure.
correct names for the, you know, for each of the tracks. Yeah, they're all a bit different. They all, they are all meant to work. If you look at pictures of the areas, which you can do actually online of some of these areas, I like to think that when the music plays, it fits the visuals, because when you're doing an album that has no vocals, has no lyrics, you are totally reliant on the music painting the picture.
Exactly.
And I always hope that if somebody looked at some of the pictures of the areas whilst they were playing the album, that they would actually see the connection or feel the connection.
Exactly. Yep. The the North Plain was cool too. It had very spacey intro, very very great tune, awesome tune.
Yeah, the North Plain, of course, it was because there's the two poles. There's the South Pole and the North Pole, often called the North Plain, and that as well, which are fascinating areas. Because as I mentioned a bit earlier, there's a lot of frozen areas. They know that there's water underneath there, which surprised everybody when they discovered that. And also the fact that it has these storms, these violent storms of raining dry ice, which is, I just find all that just fascinating. I wish, which obviously I can't, if I could go on holiday, that's where I'd go. I'd love to see all of this. But, I mean, who knows, one day my great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren might be able to.
Yeah, that's it. You never know. And,
nope.
Yeah. Have you signed up on the list maybe for one of the Mars projects?
It would be pretty good, but unfortunately, at the age of 71, I don't think there's much chance of me making that.
Well, John Glenn did it. He did do
it. Yeah, true. It's you know, mind you, some people think that I'm so out of it anyway that I've either already been there or think I'm there now. I love things that everybody's still exploring and
right.
looking for, which is why space, and I know you like it a lot,
mm-hmm.
it has such a connection with music, because there's so much about music that we don't understand where it comes from,
right.
or why it happens, and why it can create the emotions the same as things we don't understand, like space. It's such a connected, fantastic subject.
It is. I got to ask you this one question, because I talked to John Anderson a couple of times. I've talked to most of the guys from Yes. I think Steve Howe's the only guy I haven't talked to yet. But, you know, why isn't John Anderson in the band as far as the whole, you know, the whole band together again? Even without Chris, see, I thought Chris was the leader of the band at one time, but now I'm thinking it was Steve Howe. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes is such a political quagmire.
Right.
It is, and always has been. As regards leadership and who runs the band, that has always been a different person on a different day, depending on what music was happening,
right.
or what was happening as regards putting tours together or writing stuff or recording. People would step to the front and then would step back if somebody else was in charge. Chris and John were extraordinarily important, of course, because they were the founder members.
Right.
So they obviously had the respect that they deserved. John had a unique position being a singer and not playing an instrument, because he could listen to what was going on and make a good decision about how the overall sound was and how the overall music was coming together. Chris was very much wanted to be very precise and liked everybody to be very precise with what they were playing and what they were doing. And Steve pretty much the same as well. And that's how the band worked. And I was very much involved with orchestrating, putting parts together. And if things weren't actually working, then I basically stepped forward to using the musical knowledge and training I'd had to put things right. It was always a strange band. It was always very argumentative. It was always, shall we say, quite boisterous in the way that we would shout and argue with each other, and then have not fist fights, but
right.
tremendous verbal fights. And there was not a lot of love lost between everybody.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Except when it came to music,
yeah.
because everybody had tremendous respect for every other member,
right.
and tremendous respect for what they did musically within the band. And that's all that mattered.
Yeah.
It didn't matter. We all had completely different lifestyles apart from the music. And it was the music that brought us together. And I often used to say to people, look, when you go to work, if you work in an office, you know, do you love everybody in your office?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm sure you respect the people who do a good job.
Yeah.
And the other thing that's difficult about being in a band is if you are working in an office, you get up in the morning with your family, you have your breakfast, you travel to work, you work, have a lunch, come home in the evening, and that's it. If you're in a band and you're working, you're on the road, you get up in the morning and you see them straight away. You have breakfast, you have working together all day long, you're doing concerts, you're
yeah.
traveling together, you're flying together. The only time you don't see anybody is when you're actually going to bed.
Yeah.
And I wonder how many relationships of anybody could stand that. It's unique in the music industry. And Yes was one of those that we learnt in the end, as indeed we did with Anderson, Raven and Wakeman, and the last Yes tour that I did, which was finished in 2005, 2006. We learnt to give each other space, because that's what made it work.
Yep.
And if you give each other space, then it's very easy when you come together to make music. And I think that there was a period that where it didn't actually happen like that. When John was the band wanted to continue. I didn't want to continue without John.
Right.
I felt that without John, as the singer of the band, then you didn't truly have a yes. Chris Allen and Steve wanted to carry on,
mm-hmm.
and I gave them my back. I said, fine, if that's what you want to do, you do that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they asked me, they said, can you recommend a keyboard player? And I recommended my son, Oliver, because he'd worked with Steve, sure. and they'd gone on well. And in fact, Oliver was in the band for a couple of years. But for me, you can't have a yes without John or Chris. And when, obviously with no John there, I never felt it was truly was a yes band. But then certainly when Chris passed away, I did feel that then that was the time to retire the name.
Right.
Not retire the music, yeah, carry on playing the music, calling bands anything they wanted to. And I think that would have worked fine. But for me, the name, when Chris went, they should have been retired. But it's only a personal opinion.
I'm with you 100%, Rick. I'm a big Yes fan from way back. And when John was ousted, basically, because, you know, I felt sorry for him because he was sick. We talked about that, because when he went into the hospital, I went into the hospital, and it was, you know, it's very difficult to go through something like that. You know, I mean, the guy almost died, you know. And
yeah, I know. I mean, I called him quite regularly. We talked, and that's how we ended up a couple of years later doing the Living Tree album together.
Right.
I thought there were a lot of things that I was very unhappy about during that period. But, you know, I didn't say anything because I didn't feel it was my place to say anything. And, you know, I really didn't want to upset anybody, but I felt that John was treated.
Yeah.
Pretty badly.
Well, I did tell Chris that. I told him I was very unhappy with it, and that, you know, to replace him with a you know, the guy they replaced him with, which was a
Ben Wall.
Yeah, with the, you know, a what do you call it when they gosh, I'm losing it. See, now I'm showing you my age.
Basically, somebody from one of the Yes tribute bands.
A tribute band. That's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, that's what they. That's what they do. You think, oh, you don't do that.
No. Yeah. And I've had Billy Sherwood on the show a couple of times, and I know he's doing his best to keep it going for Chris and everything. But still, it's just not the same.
But that's an interesting thing. I mean, I know Billy well. I like Billy. He's a good player, nice guy. But nobody's keeping Yes going for Chris Squire.
Right.
That's not why Yes is going. It's not there as a memorial to Chris.
Right.
The music is a memorial to Chris.
Right.
So Yes music could be played by anybody, and it's a memorial to Chris.
Sure.
The Yes name has nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
Yes was purely a vehicle to make the Yes music that we were making at the time. So, you know, I don't think Yes is carrying on for the sake of Chris. And I think if anybody thinks that, then there's something wrong somewhere. But, you know, it's of no consequence to me. I mean, I'm very proud to have been with Yes. I'm very proud of the work that I did with Yes. I'm very proud of some of the music, particularly that was created. And so I'm not going to turn around and say bad things about the band now or what should and shouldn't be, because it's none of my business. It's one of the reasons that John and I got together with Trev to put ARW together, because one of the things we did want to do, we wanted to look at Yes music in the way that we saw it and play it. And that's the reason that we did that. I'm certainly not ever going to criticize what Steve and Alan are doing now. I still will always say that the name should have been retired.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I love John, man. He's such a nice guy.
Well, he's a real character. When I was doing the Red Planet album, I probably should have given him a ring and asked him about it, because he's undoubtedly been there as well.
Yeah. And yeah,
I love John DeBeers. We go back, right back to 1970. John and I, with those 50 years, we go back, and we've got lots of wonderful memories and lots of great times. We've had our sort of ups and downs over the years. We've had fallouts, but the great thing that John and I have always had is that when we've had a disagreement, which has always been over music,
right,
we've always managed to sit down and discuss why that happened. And one of the greatest discussions that John and I ever had was way back in 1976, when I went back to the band and out in Montreux in Switzerland. And John and I had fearsome disagreements over Tales from Topographic Oceans. And we also often had fearsome arguments over how the music was to be played, or played live or on record. And it never came to blows, but it always was very, very argumentative. When I went back in 1976, in November, John and I sat in a pub in Montreux, mm-hmm. called the White Horse, which sadly isn't there anymore, but it was at the White Horse. And we sat there, and we both said, why is it that we argue over the music and over things? And we sat there, and after analysing everything, because one of the things that was interesting was, we always ended up with the end product that we both liked.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, well, how do we do that when we disagree? And we chatted about it, and then we both, almost at the same time, said, well, we go in different directions. And we came up with the analogy at the time, which was that if we were both in London and we were flying to Tokyo, then this was at the time, of course, when you couldn't fly direct.
Right.
There were two ways of going. You could either fly with a stop-off in Moscow and then round to Tokyo, or you could fly with a stop-off at Anchorage and on to Tokyo. The thing was, we said, was we're both going to Tokyo, but I might be going via Moscow and John going via Anchorage, which means at a certain time during the making of that trip or the making of that music, we are as far apart as possible, but we're both heading for the same destination.
Right, exactly.
So we wouldn't be there. We said, that's it. We decided then that we weren't going to question some of the routes that John and I in particular took to get to our destination, as long as we got to that destination, and we always did.
That's very interesting. It really is. Huh. You know, I told John he'd make a great priest. I know his brother's a priest, but he would
he
also...
Is, yeah, I know his brother very well. Yeah. John would make a
great priest because he can command people when he speaks, when he talks. He has that natural gift of that. He would be a great preacher in any religion he chose, or any form of communication that he chose. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think one of the classic things is, if he ever did that, then he should walk to whatever pulpit he chooses, playing the meeting.
Yeah. You know, I'm going to surprise you here. You know what I've been watching on YouTube? Grumpy Old Men, the TV series.
Oh, that was huge over here.
I've been watching it, man. I love it.
Yeah, it was absolutely... I mean, I did all of the series of things, and it was absolutely huge. It was primetime viewing the time, and it was great. Initially, it was really good. There was a wonderful man called Stuart Prebble, great producer and director, and what he used to do, he would sit you in a room or somewhere, nobody else around, a camera in front of you, he'd stand behind and he'd just say, women drivers. And you'd have to just ramble away about women drivers. And then he'd stop you after about 20 minutes and he'd go, politicians, and away you'd go again.
It's great.
And he did that with a load of us. And then what he would do, he would take out sound bites that he would like and then scripted the whole program around the sound bites. Now, that worked really well because none of us knew what he was going to ask us. But then, and I mentioned the politicians before, the BBC decided that they wanted politicians in the programme.
Huh.
So they said to him, you have to have politicians. The problem with that is none of them can speak off of the cuff.
Right.
None of them could just ad-lib. So all of them wanted to know the questions beforehand and then got their writers to write the answers for them or what they were going to say. And so whenever you look at a politician or grumpy old man in England, you can spot it instantly that they rehearsed and practiced what they were going to say. And that was the moment when my friend said, that's the end of the program.
That's the end of the program, right. Well, you had Jeremy Clarkson, of course, from Top Gear, Bob Geldof,
yes.
John Peel, and of course yourself, and many, many, many others. Some of my favorite things, you know, you guys were talking about a cup of coffee. You just can't get it standard anymore.
Oh,
which is true.
It's true. That's, you know, the days of just having, I do want coffee. I do want coffee with a drop of milk in. You know, it's impossible. You know, they've got all these great fancy names now, the flat white, lardy, decaf, or whatever.
Yeah.
I just want a cup of coffee. I mean, it's not rocket science. You know, they give all these fancy names because then they can add a few bucks on the price.
Right, right.
You know, it's just, it drives me mad. There's a few things that drive me. Like, coffee is one of them. I like my coffee, but why have we made it so complicated? We made it complicated so that people can make money.
Yeah, yeah. And then, of course, everybody wants to lend you money. You don't need it, but they want to lend it to you.
That's another big one. Yeah, you go to the bank and say, can I borrow some money? The reason you've gone to the bank is because you need to borrow some money.
Yeah.
When you don't need to borrow some money, they come on to you and say, would you like to borrow some money?
Exactly.
You go, well, no, I don't need to borrow some money. Why don't you lend it to me when I need it? it's so true.
It is true.
It's quite incredible. I shake my head, you know. I don't know.
And how about you? The first time you sat on Santa's lap, you said he reeked of scotch, and I sat on his lap. Santa put his hand on my knee, and I got off.
Yeah, that's about it. I mean, it's a lot different now because there's very strict rules and regulations. But back when I was a kid, most Santas were outdoor actors,
right.
Who hid the whiskey bottle under their cloak. It's bizarre. I mean, there's some strange times. That's life, what you grow up with.
Yeah. And then, of course, there's the nanny state. That was another good one. The nanny
state. What, sorry?
The nanny state. Nanny, N-A-N-N-Y, the nanny state.
Oh, I'm sorry, oh yeah, oh absolutely. Yeah, that was funny. When you treat people like kids, expect them to act like kids, which means irresponsible, and rebellious. I don't know, what were you like when you were a kid?
I was rebellious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a classic thing, it's human nature. If somebody tells you not to climb over that wall, what do you do when no one's looking? You climb over the wall.
Sure.
You know, it's how I got my kids to do things when my kids were young. You know, I'd say to them, whatever you do, don't get dressed early and be ready for school at 8:30.
Uh-huh.
And that was the only way I got them ready.
That's funny. But that's a great show. You know, they should have carried it over to the States here because it would have been accepted here. I mean, it would have been wonderful.
We actually talked about it, funny enough. We actually talked about taking it over to America. Because Steve Preble is still a great friend of mine, and he was, and I was the only idiot that he had in every program. We talked to him about taking it to America and having some, some UK, some English people, but also then having an equal amount of Americans having it together, so that it was a bit of an international grumpy old man. And I think it could have worked, but for whatever reason, nobody took it up. But I still think it would work and work now. We talked about doing a road show, of taking it on the road as well, which could be three that were going to do it.
Yeah.
But it never came off at the end. And it's something that I've thought about that I'd love to put together, if it could be done. Because I still think it's got a lot of legs.
I think so, yeah. And you're a funny guy. I mean, you know, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame is a test to that.
Well, the Hall of Fame, that wasn't planned. That was how that came about. I mean, I should say before going further, I love award ceremonies.
Right.
I always watch the Oscars, the Emmys, you know, everything. I watch all the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But the thing that amazes me is the speeches,
mm-hmm.
which are the most boring in the whole world.
Exactly.
I mean, how many times, whether it's the Oscars or it's the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, can somebody thank their mother or their father or their first art director or the first person who bought them a guitar
right.
or the first person who gave them a chance to appear on stage? But nobody gives a toss. The
right.
audience know the answers already.
Yeah.
That's why they're there. They know all of that.
Yeah.
So why tell them? All that people want to hear, really, I think, in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they want to hear the band play.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
what they want to do, and it's
yeah.
great. And the speeches, they're just boring, the same as the Oscars. I mean, my good friend Ricky Gervais, something like, I mean, they are boring, the speeches.
Yeah, I agree.
And you know, there's only so many times you can cry. And I think the thing was with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it was a fantastic event, and I was very, very proud to be part of the band, to be inducted. But when the speeches were going out, I could hear this hum going all around the auditorium of 17,000 people talking. It was just a... and nobody was listening. They were just waiting for the band to play.
Right.
And Trevor and John both know that I do a lot of comedy in the UK,
right.
a lot of stand-up stuff as well.
Yeah.
And just before I went up to do my... Trevor said, oh, for God's sake, liven it up. And I said, I'm not known for comedy in America. He said... Doesn't matter. Go for it.
Yeah.
So I went up there and I thought, well, and there was just this hum going around. So I started with just a couple of one-liners. And people seemed to, like, really enjoy it. It was a nice break from everything else that had gone on. So, you know, I did a little short spot, and I had no idea of the reaction that it would get from people, which was lovely. And it was not meant to be insulting or detrimental in any way to anybody. It was just meant to be a bit of a light-hearted fun, because everybody knows that I want to thank my dad and my mum and my music teacher.
Right. Sure.
Because it's Bob Moog and all those people. But everybody knows that. So let's have a bit of fun. And I got so many phone calls, emails and texts from people in the music business, artists that, some of them whom I've never even met, obviously knew because they're famous, never met before, that just went, thank God somebody did that. Well done. You know, and so as I say, it wasn't meant to be rude or
right.
disrespectful.
Sure.
It's just that I have a bit of what you said you were when you were little. It's my rebellious streak.
Sure. I think you need your own talk show. I think you're that good.
I tell you what, I've been offered it in the UK, but I've never had a chance because I've never had a period of time where I've been able to
exactly.
dedicate to do it. But I would love
you would
to have
be
a
great
talk
at
show.
It. You
I've
would be awesome.
Anything else, I'd actually like to have a talk show in the US.
You because, would be awesome.
I think there's so much more opportunity to take a talk show to another level. Mm. I mean, I've always admired American talk shows.
Yeah.
I mean, I was a huge Johnny Carson
Me
fan.
Too. Me too.
I have the DVD sets of all of his wonderful. I thought Johnny Carson was the epitome of a talk show host. That he had his monologues, he had his sketches that he did,
yeah.
but when he had guests on, he let them talk.
Yeah.
And he only butted in when he wanted to just guide them in the direction he wanted them to go in. Very, very, very clever guy. And I think that there's that kind of route could be taken one stage further. But I think at my age, I'm unlikely to get the opportunity.
Well, you never know. You're still a young guy. You're not that old, Rick.
Well, it's very kind of you to say so. I mean, sometimes I feel my age, but I try not to.
No. You know, who I like too is Graham Norton. You know?
Oh, Graham's brilliant. I know Graham very well.
He's excellent.
I used to host a comedy show over here called Live at Jongler's. I hosted that for about 8 years on national television. And Graham, I had Graham on before he was like famous as he is now. And he was brilliant.
He
has a natural ability. And one of the things that I like about Graham is his offstage persona. It's exactly the same as on. He's very clever, but he also has that ability on his show of letting people talk and only interrupting when he wants to move them to a certain direction.
Right.
He's really, really good, Graham. Very funny guy. He's a fine comic actor as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you ever get the chance to, they're on YouTube, you can find them. He was part of a series called Father Ted.
Okay, I didn't know that.
And if you look up Father Ted,
mm-hmm.
and look at the ones where he played a priest, hilariously funny. Very clever guy.
I have a lot of
respect for Graham Norton.
He's so quick. That's what I like about him.
Yeah.
He's so quick.
Oh yeah, he's quick. He's fast, and funny enough, I've not seen him since Live at Jongler's to chat to him, but hopefully I might get the opportunity again one day because he's a clever guy.
He should have you on the show, right?
Yeah, that'd be nice.
Yeah.
Will you tell him or shall I?
I will. Well, both of us will. How's that?
That sounds good.
Well, one other thing I wanted to mention about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame was I think Geddy Lee's a perfect fit for Yes, man.
Geddy is brilliant, and he did a fantastic job.
He did.
Playing with it. I mean, it was very hard to know what to do because obviously, sadly, with no Chris there.
Right.
And Geddy I've known for a long time. Very talented guy. Great bass player, loves music, loves Yes, I really wanted to do it. So that he was a perfect fit. And I think that if there ever was any form of classic Yes put back together again, Geddy would be brilliant for it. But I think the time has passed, if I'm going to be brutally honest with you now.
Yeah, it's a shame. It is a shame. Rick, here's your final question. I ask this question to everybody. I get some very interesting answers. If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie, to perform, collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
Oh, crikey. I could actually come up with a huge list of people that I'd like to collaborate with.
Well, you can do that. You can name a few.
Okay. If I'm allowed more than one.
Sure.
Amy Winehouse. I would have loved to have worked with her on her writing with the piano.
Mm-hmm.
I think she sadly died way before she matured to what she undoubtedly would have become. But I was never always excited by some of the musical arrangements that went behind it. I would love to have done that. I'd love to have worked with Prokofiev,
mm-hmm.
Who is my big musical hero. I would love to have worked with him, although whether he would have liked to have worked with me, heaven only knows. And comedians, if it was comedy stuff, I'd love to have worked with John Cleese. I mean, I have met John, but I'd love to have worked with him.
Yeah.
You know, if I might do this tonight now, I might just sit down with a pen and pad and write down everybody who I would love to collaborate and work with. And I tell you what, I bet I'd still be writing names tomorrow morning.
You know, I could see you in Monty Python easily.
Well, the late Terry Jones, who died recently, was a really good friend of mine.
Yeah.
I knew Terry very well. Eric Idle, I knew. I mean, it's just a wonderful era of madness. I mean, there's another great comedian from that period of time called Griff Rhys-Jones,
mm-hmm.
Who is a very, very funny man. If you want to have a good example of what Griff did, his name's Griff Rhys-Jones. Go on to YouTube and check out Griff Rhys-Jones, John McEnroe. Huh. He does a sketch of John McEnroe, which is one of the funniest things I have ever seen. And the irony is, I'd never met Griff until last year.
Right.
And I moved home, and when I moved home, he turns out to be one of my near neighbors, and we've become great friends.
How about that?
Check him out.
John McEnroe.
Well, it's Griff Rhys-Jones, YouTube, John McEnroe.
I sure will. Rick, I'm going to be promoting the album like hell because it's fantastic. The Red Planet, five stars all the way.
That's really kind. Thank you.
You got three books. You got Say Yes, which is an autobiography. You got Grumpy Old Rockstar and Other Wondrous Stories. And you got Further Adventures of a Grumpy Old Rockstar. We're going to push all those books as well because they're incredible reads.
Thank you, Sam. You're really kind. Thank you.
Sure. What do you think's going to happen? I know with the pandemic and this and that, nobody can tour, but are you going to be able to promote the album on tour or anything, or what's going
to
happen?
Well, we're putting in dates for next year, which we'd like to do. I mean, being able to tour is very reliant upon agents and promoters wanting us to tour, and that then is reliant upon how successful the album is. But we are trying to make plans to play it live. Obviously, the pandemic and the theatre and the auditorium shutdowns has made life really, really difficult. And I think reality is, will they get a vaccine to cure it? I think that's unlikely because they haven't got one for the flu.
Right.
But obviously, you've got like the flu jab, which helps your immune system fight off these things. I think that's the best we can hope for. And if that happens with some form of herd immunity, then who knows? We might just get through this. But it's not anything like anything that I've ever experienced in my life. And, you know, I've got a couple of friends who are pretty old, bless them, and who are in their sort of like 80s and 90s, who remember the war.
Yeah.
And they remember being bombed at the Blitz.
Yep.
And they said, the difference between then and now, because I said, is it the same? And they said, no, because then we knew what the enemy was.
Exactly.
We could see it.
Exactly.
We can't see this one.
Yeah.
And I think that is the thing that's funny. We can't see it. I do feel sorry for doctors, nurses, for politicians, for everybody who keeps getting asked questions for which nobody knows the answer.
Yeah.
You know, so it's so difficult. And I think the best thing really is just for a lot of honesty. Well, people say, at the moment, we don't know the answer, but we're working hard to try and find it.
I agree with you, 100%. Yep. Rick, thank you so much, man, for being on the show today. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed being on. Thank you.
Rick, you are wonderful, man. You're the best keyboard player in the world. You've always have been. The only guy that's kind of close to you maybe is Keith Emerson, who I chatted with as well. He was a great guy.
Oh, he was. I miss Keith and John Lord. I was
tragically,
at both their funerals. Keith was very difficult for me.
Yeah.
Because I stood in the church and watched his, you know, Mary come in with her grandchildren. And it was different from John Lord's funeral because I stood there and thought, I shouldn't be here. Keith shouldn't be in that coffin.
Right.
He should still be alive.
I know.
John, of course, was slightly because he was very ill. He had pancreatic cancer.
Right.
And I did the eulogy at John's funeral as well. And I lost my two best keyboard playing friends. And that's tough.
Go to Keith's Wikipedia page. I know you're not a big fan of that, but I've got a big article there with when I talked with Keith about the flying piano at California Jam.
Right. I'll go straight on and have a look now. Yeah.
He told me all about, you know, how that all worked and everything. It was pretty cool. He was such a nice guy. You know, we talked for about an hour.
Oh, he was great, Keith.
Yeah.
We got on great. Next time we speak, because it's quite a long story, ask me about the time he and I were locked in the lavatory together.
And next time we speak, I want to talk to you about the Freemasons.
Oh, yeah, no problem.
Yeah, that's
absolutely.
I'm very interested with that as well.
Yeah, well, anytime you anytime you want. Just let us know. We'd be happy to talk to you about that.
That'd be great. Thank you so much, Rick. You're wonderful,
thanks,
man. God bless.
Cheers. Bye.
Cheers. Bye-bye now. Purchase, keyboard legend Rick Wakeman and the English Rock Ensemble return to Prague on the new album, The Red Planet. You can order yours today at www.musicglue.com/Rick Wakeman Emporium. It will be available on Amazon. It should be by now. I think the MP3 is available, but the CD and the discs are not, the album is not available as of yet, but it should be any time now. Limited CD plus DVD edition in deluxe pop-up packaging. The Red Planet, Rick Wakeman's 2020 studio album. The album harks back to Wakeman's critically acclaimed 1973 solo debut album, The Six Wives of Henry VIII, and No Earthly Connection. These releases showcased heavy keyboards and focus on a central theme. Rick recorded The Red Planet with a collective of musicians dubbed the English Rock Ensemble, featuring guitarist Dave Cochran, bassist Lee Pomeroy, and drummer Ash Sloan. Pomeroy has also been a touring member of Yes, featuring Anderson, Raven, and Wakeman, and Jeff Lynne's ELO, while Sloan has been played drums with The Squeeze, Del Amitri, and many other artists. Books by Rick Wakeman say yes. He's got an autobiography out, available at Amazon. Also, Grumpy Old Rockstar and Other Wondrous Stories, available at Amazon. And Father Adventures, Further Adventures of a Grumpy Old Rockstar, also available on Amazon.com. For more information about Rick Wakeman, visit www.rwcc.com. Rick's also on Facebook, www.facebook.com/Rick Wakeman Music. And also, of course, on Twitter, Twitter's Grumpy Old Rick. Very special thanks to the great Billy James of Glass Onion PR for arranging this interview with Rick Wakeman and the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsom of VBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. Please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. It's real news, people. And, of course, my new book. It's finally out. It's entitled The Rockstar Chronicles. It's Series 1. I hope to get at least 4 of these out. Chronicles truths, confessions, and wisdom from the music legends that set us all free. Order yours today on hardcover or ebook. It's a collector hardcover edition at BookBaby.com, also available on Amazon.com. It features over 45 intimate conversations with some of the greatest rock legends the world will ever know. And it's also a Gold Star Award winner. Thank you so much. Have a great week, everybody. Stay safe. And please wear a mask. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on VBS Radio, Station 1.